Hello, everybody. Welcome to the last lecture of our series of lectures that accompany the exhibition upstairs on graphic modernism that you can see. My name is Wojciech Siemaszkiewicz, and I am curator of the West Slavic Collection and the Slavic and Baltic Division located in room 217 upstairs. If you haven't been there, I would welcome you to go there and see additional items that we exhibit there, which supplement the graphic modernist exhibition downstairs here. Today's speaker is Matthew Witkowski, who is the associate curator in the Department of Photographs at the National Gallery of Art, and he's also a curator of the photo exhibition currently at Guggenheim Museum. It will close this week, so if you haven't seen it, you still have a chance to see that show. Our show upstairs closes at the end of this month. Matthew has been dealing with the topic for many years, and when I attended yesterday this discussion panel at the Czech Center, he mentioned that he's been working on his show for about 12 years, so it's a long time. Both exhibitions have their own catalogs. Ours is a little catalog available upstairs, and Matthew's exhibition has a much bigger catalog that you can buy at Guggenheim or order online. So I would encourage you to do so. Please welcome Matthew Witkowski. Thank you.
Thank you, Wojciech. Thank you all for coming here to listen to this lecture. I did not know it was the last in the series. I'm sorry that I, living in Washington, have not been able to attend the others. And yes, I suppose that all the others related directly to the exhibition upstairs. This show, as you heard, is at the Guggenheim uptown. So, but it was conceived in a close collaboration with Steven Monsbach and also at the end with Wojciech. The show that I put together for the National Gallery, and which is now traveling around, covers the region of Central Europe from the end of World War I to the end of World War II. Central Europe covering with less territory than what you have upstairs, Germany, Hungary, Austria, the former Czechoslovakia, and Poland. And the idea was to give a history of photography that would actually importantly address the creation of a history for photography as art, and I'll talk about that a little later, and at the same time to give an account, a more precise account maybe than has been given to date, of what it meant to be modern in Central Europe in the 1920s and 30s. And the method used was to think of eight themes that cut across the region. Every country in the region is represented to some degree in each one of the thematic sections. And to present as much in cultural and an institutional or political history as a look at any particular set of people, individuals working in the region, although there are great ones, Renger Patch there on the left, for instance, or Funke on the right. So it's a history of photography that is also a history of modernity, shall we say, in Central Europe. And to explain what modernity meant specifically really takes this, it demands this sort of thematic narrative, I found, rather than one that would go country by country, let's say, or art movement by art movement. There are very specific qualities to becoming modern in the region, which is sort of pushed into modernity almost overnight at the end of World War I, when all these countries come into being. They either stop being empires or they stop being subject lands and become nation states. And very often industrial modernization and urbanization and other things that we associate with modernity, the emergence of department stores and a mass media market and things like that, are also burgeoning right there at the end of World War I or only a few years before. So becoming modern in some almost factual, you know, sense is something that happens a bit later than elsewhere in Europe, and it happens under very different conditions, really almost traumatic conditions with World War I and its end. And then they lead, although the show is not in any way intended to be apocalyptic, but of course the end point of this show is World War II. And the annihilation that brought. So there are very specific conditions to being modern in the region that also come forth in the photography. And with that, I will give a look at the sections of the show one by one and see if I can explain what is undoubtedly for you a cryptic introduction. But let's see. So we'll start with a good screaming image. The first section of the show is called The Cut and Paste World, Recovering from War. And the first and the last sections are bookends for the show, and they treat the subject of photomontage. Photomontage is commonly known by specialists in modern art as a product of Germany and Russia just after World War I. But it turns out that it really is a Central European-wide phenomenon. There are very important contributions to early photomontage by the Czechs and the Poles and also the Serbs and Croats, who unfortunately aren't represented in this show, but you can see some examples upstairs. And photomontage for the Berlin Dada group, which is the pioneer group for photomontage, in early 1919, for them, photomontage was a perfect way to analyze and excoriate the current social situation, the hypocrisies that had led to World War I, the things that weren't adding up in the aftermath. We should remember that it's a good 2 or 3 years of civil war and unrest and infighting and around the region as things shake out after the war. A piece such as John Hartfield's self-portrait, which was presented at the Berlin Dada Fair in 1920, and that whole entire exhibition is one gigantic photomontage, basically. A piece such as this is really this sort of primal scream against the world. It was actually accompanied at the fair by, it was stuck on, that's what the tape marks around the edges you can see, stuck onto a larger poster that has since disappeared, where he was crying out this phrase from the mid-19th century about how photography will suppress and replace all painting one day. So he's actually screaming about art, but of course he's also screaming about the world around him. Quite interestingly, the strategies that the Dadaists employed of a very violent fragmentation and a chaos of imagery and very cuttingly comical analyses of everyday situations. Those strategies were picked up on by Czechs and Poles and Serbs and Croats and others, but they morphed into something rather different because the situation in those countries was different. It was much more optimistic, really. I mean, these were countries that were born out of the war and became free as a result of the war. And so not surprisingly, artists who wanted to be in touch with their time and their place had an exuberance to them. Which doesn't mean that they weren't oppositional or biting or critical, but it just means that they also had this real drive, I mean, which ultimately ended up being the case in Germany and in Austria as well. It was an incredibly exciting period in the 20s, trying to figure out what directions to go in. And so a piece like this, Smoke Over the City, Dymy nad miastem, which is the very, very oversized maquette to a book cover, which in the end the book is only about that big, It features, it's made in the year that Józef Piłsudski takes over the Polish government, and it has a distanced stance vis-a-vis that coup, but Piłsudski actually was a sort of a hero to leftists in the beginning because he was going to bring law and order and new possibilities to the country. And so you have this, you know, very nice aerial view of processions down a street. At the same time, though, this the very shakiness of the soldier in the middle, very like flimsily propped up on these hands as if being manipulated like a puppet from above. There are these little witty comments on the uncertainties of the time, which come through very delightfully in works such as that. And then with the Devyatsil group in Prague, you have this absolutely radiant look at modern life, the new possibilities that you had now that passports were available. It's amazing the basic new things that were introduced, the passport. And you could take your passport and go around Europe relatively more easily than before. And so he maps out his that red line with the arrow at one end is Taiga's summer trip through Italy and across Italy, and then he's going to go back up home. And there's a picture at the top upper right of a part of Italy in Cinque Terre where he spent some time. And he sends it, he draws a fake envelope with fake sealing wax, but then collages real canceled stamps from France, which of course wouldn't really be possible given the trajectory, but anyway. And then he unfolds his own photomontage as if it were a postcard that he was sending home. So it's a very wonderful simulation of making art through the mail, which is a common strategy of people at the time. And the Devyatsil group also made fabulous books and magazines, and you can see this book, Abeceda, the alphabet book, upstairs in the show as well. Carol Taiga, the leader of Devyatsil, made photomontages for each page of the book, which amounted to each letter of the alphabet. The book is a series of quatrains based on the alphabet. And you have at the right an original photograph. Actually, the pictures were commissioned by the dancer, Milcha Mairova. And then she produced the book, basically. So she commissioned Taiga to make the series of photomontages to go with them. They're really delightful. So from this small but very influential group of people, the avant-gardes, basically, in the various countries, the show moves a bit further outward to the schools. This second section is called Laboratories and Classrooms, and it deals again with experimental progressive photography, but it points to a really stunning fact about the region, which is that a lot of the great experimentation took place not in private ateliers or cafes or in places that were at the margins of cultural attention, but in schools that were sometimes funded by municipal governments, or in any case were accredited, and which had students earning degrees. El Lisitsky, whom you see here, taught at one such school in Russia before going for a number of years to Germany. And then Yaroslav Restler, who worked as an apprentice in the studio of František Dritikol. Dritikol also gave classes for diplomas during the 1920s. Carol Hiller, who wasn't actually a photographer, but developed a really wonderful cliché vert photographic technique that he taught at an art school in Poland, and so on. I'll give you, I guess, one more example. Walter Peter Hans, the first regular teacher of photography at the Bauhaus. Now, the Bauhaus is the one school that people somewhat familiar with the region will remember, an incredible, really the premier school for applied arts in the 20th century. It pioneered a model where students and teachers would partner with industry, producing commissions that could be sold, and the money from the regular sale of their designs would then go back into the school to feed projects at the school, and that's a model that has flourished in the decades since then. Parsons and many other many other design schools do that to some degree. The Bauhaus, though, was not the only school of its kind in the region. There was a strong tradition of arts and crafts schools in the area, and also of schools teaching photography for careers in reproductive photography or studio portraits and things like that. Vienna was the earliest in 1888, and Munich had a very important school, and there were other ones in Dresden and private schools in Berlin. And then after World War I, this exploded. The Bauhaus became an influential model, and there are a so-called Bratislava Bauhaus and also a school in Prague that reinvented itself as a sort of Bauhaus school. And then even others, hybrid versions of this in Budapest, and many others, Lviv, Krakow. So it's really an interesting thing, and it stands in relatively stark contrast to what's happening in Western Europe and in the States. There was only one school for photography in the States throughout all this time, for instance, a private school at that. And so that's a very interesting thing. And these schools really were very forward-looking and progressive, and they were very keen to publicize their students' work because they were convinced that if you believed in the future and in modernity and you believed in the possibilities for new media, then you should try to convince the greatest number of people that they're worth it. And so you have this pedagogical model that gets applied to entire countries, basically. All of Germany can be your classroom, things like this. Or Poland. This Metal piece by Janusz Maniabrzeski was made as a poster for what was called the first modernist photography salon or first modernist photography show in Poland that was held in Krakow in 1931. And it was modeled on the single great, you know, biggest exhibition of new photography and new film then or since, really, the Film and Photo Show, which started in Stuttgart, Germany, and ended up traveling to a dozen cities, including as far away as Japan, but mostly in Central Europe, in Vienna, in Zagreb. And it spawned a lot of repeats and echoes and other versions, one of them in Krakow. And so you had people coming in the tens of thousands, or in the case of FIFO, as it was known, the German one, in hundreds of thousands, okay, to see this show and its various manifestations. And that's not counting the dozens and dozens of reviews written for major daily newspapers and the books that were produced to go with that show and with others, you know, and then the lectures. A lot of these people would give lectures around, or they would publish their own articles in magazines. So we're really talking about something that's reaching a pretty great section of the population. And I will close this section by just showing an image by Jaromir Funke, one of the lesser known people from the period, who started out as an amateur photographer doing really fascinating experiments such as this. In his girlfriend's bedroom, actually, putting objects on a windowsill and letting the sunlight come through, and then placing mat board against a facing wall, sometimes using mirrors, and then having the cast shadows become the subject of the picture. A very daring work, a work that he did not initially show in the amateur salons, but which became a sort of calling card for his identity as a photographer when he became a teacher at the Bratislava Bauhaus and later at this Bauhaus-type school in Prague, the State Graphic Arts School. This is a classic example of the spread of this model far beyond Germany and beyond the Bauhaus circles. The next section in the exhibition is called New Women, New Men, and with this section and the one that follows it, we're opening up the frame of reference really to the widest possible population. In this section and the next, the pictures that are shown come from newspapers or were made for newspapers, or they spark discussions that spilled out on the pages of newspapers, and also, as I'm saying, of these very large didactic survey exhibitions. And the subjects they depict, like the wife of a painter in Cologne by August Sander on the left, or I love this terrific kitsch image on the right from Vienna, made by a studio called Atelier Manasseh. The Manasseh studio supplied glamour magazines in the 1920s and 30s in Vienna and also in Germany. And you know, we're dealing with types of people you might meet in the street every day. But of course, what's being presented are not documentary images of people as they really are. It's people how they want to be presented, or how the makers of the images. Importantly, this is a husband and wife team where the wife, on the right that is, where the wife is responsible for the concept and the art production, and the husband is the technical person, you know, snapping the shutter. So people who are managing the creation of images that address the question, what should we look like in the modern world? How should we behave? How should we live our lives? And this quality of self-presentation becomes extremely important because what commentators in Central Europe realize very, very soon is that when your world is defined by images, your world is very unstable. It shifts around. You can't really get a sense of what it is in reality. And that's a process, of course, that's been happening over several decades throughout the 19th century, but as I said earlier, more recently in Central Europe. I'm sorry to interrupt myself, but if you mind my, no. More recently in Central Europe, more suddenly and more explosively, and affecting tens of millions of people in their thinking. So for instance, Lucia Moholy, the wife of Laszlo Moholy Nagy, and a very important figure at the Bauhaus, and Lucia herself is has a real role to play here. Lucia Moholy makes a series of about 50 portraits of friends at the Bauhaus, either of their heads as here or of other parts of their body. And she is intent on conveying some sort of psychological presentation of self. Who do you think you are? Who do you want to be? How do you want to be in the world? And what's fascinating to me is how complex the presentations are. I mean, you could hardly imagine at the first glance something, anything more decided than the face of Florence Henri, a wonderful photographer herself at the Bauhaus, who's pictured on the right. You know, this very decisive haircut, the earring, the heavy earring that hangs there, and her makeup, her classic 20s makeup, the thin penciled eyebrows. And at the same time, there's something in the eyes which is contemplative and a little bit unsure, not quite decided what mask to put on, as it were. So that process of presenting yourself to the camera or working with the photographer to do that is one that creates a sensitivity to instability, as it were. And then on the left, Franz Roh, another terrific advocate for the new photography, as it was known, but who's, you know, very willfully shutting his eyes, not to see the new vision, as it were. Then you have seemingly much more straightforward pictures, such as this one from a series produced by a woman named Eva. Her real name was Elsa Friedlander Neumann. I think that's close, but I'm now suddenly blanking on the exact last name. Eva, as she was known, she fashioned this exotic, sort of unplaceable pseudonym for herself. And she pioneered this genre in the major illustrateds of the time, of the photo story, where you would have a sequence of images with very little text that would convey this narrative. And this one, very tellingly, the very first one, is about this young woman who comes from the suburbs and wants to make a name for herself in Berlin, in the capital, and has a very pretty face and looks good doing all sorts of things in the pictures, but in fact is completely hapless and untalented. And so the pictures, and unfortunately in the show I couldn't show a whole spread, but they're always paired, and in the second one you always see how untalented she is, you know. It's very funny, and this again is a story made by a woman, and in the end, this woman whose pseudonym is Ramona, not that different than Eva, ends up penniless and on the street. And so you have a woman, Eva, who really did succeed as a new woman, but making a story which is poking fun at the attempt to succeed in this new world of pure image. So it's a very complicated and interesting topic to explore. And at its most extreme, it gives us a new understanding of people like Hans Bellmer, the surrealist, who was German, although he moved to France for most of his life, but did his most important work in Germany. And his doll, this creature that he created with movable parts and then made into the most ghastly, provocative sexual poses, is in some real sense a terrific parody of the new woman, a figure who is ready to be parodied the instant she's created, as it were, because she's such a mixture of real life and absolute fantasy imagery. And from that we move into the second big, broad public section of the show, Modern Living, where it's just a whole, you know, what should I say, a smorgasbord of printed materials. Again, you see many fabulous selections in the show above. But here that there was a concentration as much on popular printed matter as on, or more really than on avant-garde or you know, specialist publications. And you can see the incredible spread of photographs into, let's say, the Slovak World, a very humdrum magazine otherwise from the early 1920s, put out in Prešov and then in Bratislava, the Slovak capital. You have Peštinoplo, the Hungarian weekly, well, it's a daily, but the weekly illustrated supplement that's in the middle, and then this Polish magazine I think that's in the, I think it's us, yeah, on the bottom there. And all using photographs and also working with very talented career photographers, Miloš Dohnányi at the top, and a guy named Rudolf Balog didn't do those, but was the art editor there for a while, and Jeski again on the bottom. So people who were trained, who had degrees in photography or degrees in the fine arts, and were absolutely thrilled to be working in the mass media, because again, they wanted to intervene in the circuits of mass production. They were not at all snobs in this regard, and that's a very interesting thing. Now, this went two directions. A man like Martin Menkészi, as we know him, a Hungarian-born but who ended up working for Life magazine and making a career in the U.S., who didn't want to intervene in mass media, wanted a career in mass media. I mean, he became a Life photographer. But that didn't mean that he didn't think his works could be art. And the size of this print, if you see the show, which is something like this, and the quality of its printing, but also the fact that it's printed matte rather than glossy, and then it's printed with this warm tone, things that don't actually reproduce that well in newspapers but look great in an exhibition print, give a sense, and we don't know exactly what show this was in, but it must have been in a show, and most likely in a show of photography as art, or that at least allowed for that possibility, as the Film and Photo Show did. So that's very interesting. This section also, you know, gives us the most gung-ho view of modernism, shall we say. Why is that doing that? I hope it won't continue to do that. Let's see. In views such as this one by Laszlo Moholy Nagy from the top of the Berlin Radio Tower, which was a centerpiece, really, in the Berlin presentation of Film and Photo, where Moholy had a whole room to his own work. And it gives us an insight, it's something on the model of that pedagogic classroom I was talking about earlier, but also if you could think about these photographs circulating through all these magazines around the region, you know, the Hungarians publishing in Germany and being looked at by the Poles and then taken again by the Czechs and things like that. It gives you the sudden insight that repetition and copying and imitation were not such a bad thing. Because just like a good student in a classroom, if you get the lesson and you can replicate it, then it shows that you've understood what's going on. And whereas we tend to think of modernism as a set of movements where everyone's claiming their own turf, and if you step onto that at all and you try to make something that looks like what someone else has done, then you're accused of being a plagiarist or second rate. But here, for instance, so in Vienna, a woman named Edith Suschitzky makes a photograph that's deliberately modeled on Moholy Nagy's. Actually, it's even closer to another variant from the same series that Moholy published in a Viennese photo journal. So it's really directly a copy. But that's done precisely to show that she understands and that she wants to bring those insights from Germany to her home country and spread them further if she can. So that's a very interesting insight you can get. At the same time, there are a lot of things, including many in this section, that don't instantly sing out the modern to viewers today. You know, peasants working in their bare feet to build the railroad, or this view of high voltage lines on the right that makes it look like a forest of trees. And that's also very deliberate, because this region is struggling to come to terms with technological modernization. And for a lot of people in the region, the instability that's created by this image world is, as I said, is a big point of concern. But also the raw facts of modernization, the drive of people from the country to the city, and the increasing automation of life, the seemingly speeded up pace of existence. I mean, these are not concerns that are unique to Central Europe. And in fact, there's a lot of the show that I think can give you a new sense of what's going on elsewhere. But they do come out with a singular richness in Central Europe and with a singular force. And part of that force, you know, is simply traditionalist. And part of it is, like here, totally hyperbolic. Chicago, which is pictured here, you know, even in the days of Al Capone, wasn't a city where people are getting shot in the back every day, as you see at the lower part of that image, and with all the cops standing helplessly by as you see the policemen at the left. But nevertheless, that was certainly, a not totally unreal picture of Chicago at the time, and especially for Poles who had a lot of countrymen going over to the U.S., this is the news they're getting back, as it were. So it can be very fantastical, and it can also be very threatening and dangerous in its propagandistic effects. And you have here the Hitler's Highway, as it was popularly known, the Reichsautobahn, which was Hitler's greatest public works project, which was claimed to reduce unemployment and to link to give great speed of access for the troops to every part of the country. And it didn't really do either of those things, but it did become a focal point for his domestic policy, which of course is not as well known as Hitler's foreign policy. But nevertheless, photographers like Paul Wolf, who took this picture, were instrumental in spreading, the good word about the highway. And you see here, the solitary car on a road totally free of traffic, a fantasy not foreign to our own country, but very far from how these things really work. And also that the highway, very importantly, is not raised up or separated from the landscape, but it seems to flow into it, and that was very calculated. Technology in this moderate to ultimately to nationalist and even Nazi view is should not be threatening. It's your friend. If it's controlled, we can control it. So the photography serves to disseminate this rather dangerous political propaganda, and that too is part of becoming modern in this region. Now the show in its final sections starts to close back in on itself. The first step toward that is a look at surrealism. This section is called The Spread of Surrealism, and surrealism is actually a popular movement, as it were, among artists anyway, throughout the region. That's not so well known, and that's part of the reason for presenting this work. This is a Polish work, again by Brzeski. It also takes on many forms in the region, from abstract splatterings, you have a Czech work on the left, to this almost documentary but strange, uncanny view of a street made by the German photographer Umbo on the right and published in a popular magazine, actually. So it takes on many forms, surrealism, but it also has many audiences, from very closed-in little circles of avant-garde artists to, again, a rather broad audience, as you can see from the work on the right. And it combines many different streams of thought, from the Bauhaus, that work on the left looks somewhat like the Bauhaus or Russian work. And it again reintroduces photomontage and in combination with various tendencies in avant-garde art. So surrealism is presented here, as sort of a surprise, really, an introduction to its manifestations in a part of Europe that isn't so commonly associated with surrealism, but that had a real core of interest there, and also to show the great breadth and variety that you can have in surrealist work. But all of it, even whether it's lighthearted or not, is oppositional, is really turning its back on many of the things I've been talking about. I'll go back, for instance, to this abstract splatter on the left. It's made as a unique work. It's made by flinging emulsion onto a glass plate and then contact printing, just sticking the plate onto a piece of photosensitive paper, and you get a single print. And then that's it. It's not made for mass reproducibility. There are elements in the surrealist movement in Central Europe, artists who very keenly are aware that we're living in this image world and are trying to go against the grain, to go against a lot of that. They're precisely not trying to communicate, not trying to teach, not trying to step out in public, not trying to circulate their images in the mass media. That's some of them. And so there is where we start to close things back down. Another form of opposition, but which is very public and pedagogic, is this so-called worker photography movement, which is probably, this and the next section are the widest movements in the region, the most widespread. And they are directly oppositional along class lines. The leaders of worker photography say that the mainstream press is resolutely middle class, and so it's not representing your interests. The pictures you see in the paper every day don't tell about your life, your working life, your struggles, etc. We need to develop our own networks with our own people going out there with cameras and taking pictures that are about us and show us, you know, in a favorable light. And very interestingly, in most of Central Europe, this is also combined with a turn to art, which you might not expect. You might say, well, if it's so politically engaged, then they want to be as un-arty as possible because art is a middle-class thing. But in fact, for much of Central Europe, the argument ran that art is what helps you see the world more clearly and better. And so if your image has artistic composition to it, as here, for instance, a very striking angle, clearly not something you would see just walking, well, across the field, let's say, then you will, it's arresting, and you will stop, and you will, your consciousness will be raised more effectively because you stopped to look at this image. And then, of course, the text plays an essential role there, too. Steer left is the name of this, very clear symbolism. It's a report on the elections in Czechoslovakia. And there, as a sideline, you have another sense of the region coming together, the same way through the mainstream illustrated press. This is an Austrian journal, but which was distributed in Czechoslovakia and in Germany and also in Switzerland, and which also covered events in those countries and in Hungary as well. So you have the region really, a network in the region. You have terrific images from this movement, again, very straightforward, and that's precisely the point. Another interesting thing to notice is that whereas we might think that photojournalists aim always to be neutral, here the thinking was that a photo reporter is precisely supposed to have a very strong point of view so that you don't mistake the point of view, so that you don't take the wrong message away from the image. That was also done by adding text. For instance, the title to the picture on the left is called The Bank Director's Bath, just in case you're missing, or Mighty Hands at the top, and then at the bottom right, hands which cannot close into fists because of calluses. So the text also playing quite an important role. Here there are other surprises, or there were surprises for me, I should say. I didn't realize to what extent Central European worker photographers focused on rural life and what they call the rural proletariat, that is day laborers but working on the land. We tend to think of worker photography as dealing with factory workers in the city and things like that. And I also wasn't aware of projects such as this by Kata Kalman, a Hungarian woman who made a book entirely composed of portraits of people, and she provided these portraits with the name and the age of the person and a little description of what they do. The prose is a bit overblown, we should say. It's not as prosaic as I'm making it sound, but still in all, the general tendency was that the work was to make the workers an allegory, like that one of the hands that can't close into fists. No head, no face. This is just the type of the worker who's suffering. But here you have a very real person who has a name, Ernő Weiss, and has an age. He's 23, and we're told where he works. And that's quite an interesting project to discover. I think I'll just pass to the next. And then the section that follows it, the homeland photography section, is the counterpart on the other side of the political divide, you might say. Traditionalist photography, or photography concerned to depict the land. Not always traditionalist, but largely. Homeland photography was the other most widespread movement in the 1930s, and it was a movement that sought to take control of forms of mass media distribution, magazines, but also, interestingly, postcards, illustrated books, even in some cases, the slide lectures from earlier, they had tried to do that, and importantly, also cinema to a degree, and to present subjects that would increase pride in one's native land. And this was at a time when, again, the identity of the land was under much more pressure even than it had been in the previous century, because these new nation states had borders that in many cases were somewhat arbitrary, and the ethnic groups on them, I mean, I don't hardly need to stress this today, we live in a time where ethnics are here and national borders are over here, and it's not at all clear what means more to whom. But in the case of Austria, for instance, which lost the vast majority of its territory and was reduced to this little rump state with hardly any influence in the world, it became super important to try to give a sense of pride in the country. The same is true in Hungary, which lost two-thirds of its territories after World War I, and again went from being an imperial seat to being just a nation among other nations. And so these views of the rural life and the people living on the land became very important. But it's equally important to remember that their presentation was done in a very modern way, in a very mass media friendly way. In Hungary, for instance, the tourist ministry subsidized numerous homeland photography projects. It was called the Hungarian style in Hungary, but they even had people dress up in folk costume and perform native dances, again, to be filmed and photographed. So this was a very active state movement, really. Here are more examples of that. And then as a final example from this section, which is more complicated in a way than the worker photography section, you have at the same time people like Albert Ranger Patch in Germany who have a keen awareness that the land is being grabbed from under them, that land grabbing is in fact the major instrument of Nazi foreign policy and the major subject for discussion at the time, much more, let's say, than ethnic self-determination. It's the question of who is going to name this land, who is going to run this land. And all the ethnics are going to pay the price, basically. And so you have images like this, which are very forlorn. Actually, this one made in 1929, and which becomes prophetic of the, you know, the seizure of the land and the sort of the puny stature of people who would try to do something to prevent that. And with that, we come to the final section, where we return to photomontage and return to war, to the cut and paste world. A work here by John Hartfield, a man I talked a little bit about in the opening of this lecture, with a piece that he actually first produced in 1924, 10 years after World War I, and then reprised here in 1934. The first time it was a reminder of how bad the war had been, and the second time it's with grim foreboding of what the coming war will bring. And I mean, by that time it's very clear to people like Hartfield that war is on the horizon, even though it's 5 years away. Here we are also back at a close circle of avant-gardists, some of whom, like Mariana Brandt, don't actually even publish or exhibit their images in any way, and yet very interestingly they address public subjects, current affairs, if you will. That's Marlene Dietrich on the left of this image, waving goodbye as she leaves Germany for the U.S., never to return. We've learned recently that the image in the middle, the girl's head, very large, it's from a Russian picture by Arkady Shaiket of a Jewish, proletarian Jewish colony, a summer camp to educate young Jewish kids in of the importance of communism, of the socialist future. However, that future looks far from bright or certain in this image. So very interestingly, a comment on public affairs and on the news, but one that is not made public. Then you have work by Hans Bellmer, let's say, who manages to escape to France, but has to leave behind in Germany the third version of his doll sculpture, which he photographs here, and gives the work the title The Machine Gunneress in a State of Grace. A complete manifest subversion of military equipment in favor of sexual transgression, a sort of a very caustic entry into, or a transgression of the public sphere with private subject matter, right? Sex and the bedroom is now made into the battlefield. And then you have people who were not able to get to France, Jindřich Heisler on the left, who spent several years of World War II in hiding in Prague, where he made a terrific series of altered photographs. and on the right, work from a series by a Polish artist, Władysław Strzemiński, who was the leading abstract painter in Poland before the war, and a committed socialist who survived the war very close to the Lodz ghetto, and made this series about the ghetto's inhabitants and their extermination directly after Lodz was liberated by Russian troops in early 1945, and then donated the series to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. A very poignant and troubling set of works. And then to return to one other figure from the first section at the very end, Karol Tajga, the leader of Dewiecil, who, like Mariana Brandt, made photomontages that he never exhibited or published. He circulated them, gave them away to friends during the war. Most of them were made throughout the years of the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia and during the war. Reusing, in this case, a nude by Jaromir Funke, the man who had made those abstract shadows I showed you before. That's the woman with the hands like this, which Tajga obviously found two copies of and, you know, cut them up and put them against each other. And then behind that, this figure of hands, an enigmatic, a fabulous image from that period. And so that brings us to the end, and so that we don't end on an utterly sad note, I show you the coda to the exhibition, a souvenir it's called, by Jindřich Marko, another piece that brings the region together, because Marko is a Czech photographer who traveled all over the region photographing the immediate aftermath of World War II, and here he's found a pair of soldiers, just as they've somehow managed to locate a studio photographer and ask for their portrait to be taken, and this photographer in turn has from somewhere rustled up a studio decor, a nice, pleasing tree in the landscape. And so I guess that what the soldiers got was a pretty nice picture, although you can't see it, but the thing is torn in the upper left. So they would have seen that part. But what Marko gives us, of course, is the whole scene. Warsaw is 85% destroyed. It's absolutely flattened from the Allied bombings and from other, from German retreat and things. And so this is the picture that we have coming after the war, and yet we do still have a photographer acting, you know, out in the public, and the something of the old role of the studio photographer there. And I guess that this show, the photo show, is really a sort of brick by brick reconstruction, in some sense, of that period. And Warsaw, in fact, was rebuilt brick for brick in the decades that followed, too. But, of course, the results are not the original, and that's not the point. The results are interpretive. They are a very, deliberately personal look at a survey, but nevertheless with an incisive view to try to give us a sense of how the structure stood, as it were, in the 20s and 30s. So thank you for your attention.
Any questions, please?
STRZ, EM as in Mary, IN like Nancy, SKI. Sure. Yes. Oh, the one of him, the self-portrait. Uh-huh.
What was the policy of the other Nazi cultural leaders for
Right. A national interest, maybe. Yes. First of all, well, that self-portrait is from 1920. Goebbels had joined Hitler's newly founded party, which actually was founded in 1919, and he had already joined, but he wasn't giving speeches yet. But it does, you know, a lot of German politicians sounded like that, you know, so it was easy to caricature them at the time. And there are already pieces in the Berlin Dada movement. For instance, a wonderful photomontage painting, a painting with newspaper elements in it by Otto Dix that shows a man lying on the street and there's a newspaper open next to him and it says Juden raus, Jews out. And this is 1920, so it's very clear from the beginning. As for the rest of the question, yes, the Nazis had a very clear interest in that. Well, I mean, they are famous for having realized early on the power of the mass media. And that what was more important was to record yourself and broadcast it than your personal interaction. And even the personal presentations, like the rallies, were staged so that for most people the person was a tiny image there. I mean, if they had had rear projection back then, you can bet that they would have been really large behind them. But they made films famously with Leni Riefenstahl and others. And interestingly, they did not present photography in all of its technological glory, because they also understood that they could play on the fear of the modern as much as being ultra-modern. And so they didn't, for instance, in the views of Hitler's highway, the views that showed the highway in its most nakedly sort of modern and technological were generally painted or drawn. But the project was extensively documented in photographs, and selected other photographs of, let's say, the beautiful countryside around and the houses and things like that were published in books that were about the highway. Die schöne Straße is one, the beautiful highway. And, you know, so this is very, very calculated. It's not so important to do a thing. And in fact, the highway didn't do much by the time Hitler was done with it. And it wasn't even his idea. It was already in the works. But it was very important to publicize, and photography could help there. Yes. Oh, yeah.
You said there was one American school in South Carolina. Can you please tell me what city was it in?
New York, the Clarence White School. White was an associate of Alfred Stieglitz, and he opened up a private school, I think, in 1911, but it might be earlier even. I could be wrong about that. And Paul Strand is one of the most famous graduates. But yeah, that was the only real school for making art photographs. Otherwise, you just sort of learn the trade with studio people and you set up your own studio. It wasn't actually so tightly regulated as it was in Europe. All right. Nope. In terms of handing out licenses and who could own studios and things like that. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming.